From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Dr. Jonathan Kimmelman from McGill University is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling on the ethics of conducting clinical trials with novel biotechnologies in the developing world. Dr. Jonathan Kimmelman is assistant professor in the Biomedical Ethics Unit and Social Studies of Medicine Department at McGill University. He holds a PhD in molecular biophysics and biochemistry from Yale University. Dr. Kimmelman's research focuses on the ethics of translational clinical trials involving novel techniques such as gene transfer and cell transplantation, particularly in developing countries. Dr. Kimmelman, you and Dr. Alex John London from Carnegie Mellon University published a commentary in the July 5th issue of The Lancet. Your article addressed issues related to conducting early-stage clinical trials in the developing world. You both suggested that this practice may be inconsistent with international ethics guidelines on justice. Can you elaborate?
Well, first, I want to make it absolutely clear that there's no reason why phase one trials couldn't, in principle, be consistent with international policies. You know, the health deprivations that are confronted by low-income countries are not going to be overcome without substantial investments in research, and we're seeing large investments in research right now with various vaccine initiatives, et cetera. So I want to make it absolutely clear that our argument is not trying to suggest in any way that phase one trials are incompatible with international guidelines on justice. The main thrust of our argument was that much of the discussion around fairness in clinical trials pursued in low and middle income countries centers around phase three randomized controlled trials. And for those kinds of studies, what matters a lot in terms of ethicality is whether or not the drugs are going to be provided at the completion of the trial to participants. The problem is for phase one studies, these aren't designed to vindicate interventions. You are mainly testing safety, dosage. You may be gathering some preliminary indication of efficacy, but at the completion of a phase one study, it doesn't make sense to be providing an intervention to participants at the completion of the trial. What's more is with something like gene transfer, where you're making stable genetic modifications in many instances, post-trial access is completely irrelevant. For a condition like hemophilia, you may be providing as much as 7 to 10 years of stable treatment for a condition. And so what our article was really trying to address is the particularities of how one would extend some of the requirements with respect to fairness and justice to phase one studies that were looking at interventions that are technologically complex and that in some cases would provide a fairly stable intervention strategy. So I guess to sum that up, there are certain sort of fairness concerns that come up around phase one studies. And the reason we sort of wrote this article is because much of the discussion of fairness has, you know, looked at post-trial access rather than looking at the whole responsiveness issue.
Now, in the Lancet commentary, you and Dr. London note that one of the reasons for writing the article was to clarify two questions surrounding international research that you believe have received scant attention. Would you please identify those two questions?
One of them was, under what conditions is it fair and consistent with international guidelines to pursue phase one studies in low and middle income countries, or for high income countries rather, to pursue these studies in low and middle income countries? Secondly, what exactly do these international guidelines mean by responsiveness? So there's a general consensus, if you look at various policy documents, both national as well as multilateral or international documents, that there are two conditions that need to be fulfilled in order for a transnational study to meet appropriate ethical standards of justice. One of them is provisions for post-trial access to interventions, and the other is responsiveness. And as I indicated earlier, there's been a lot of discussion about what exactly it means to provide post-trial access. And that's not to say that all of the kinks and interpretations have been ironed out in that, but that's what really the main focus has been in ethics and policy literatures. But unfortunately, that's left unaddressed the problem of what exactly these international codes mean by responsiveness. And so what our article tried to do was to articulate what we thought would be a very reasonable interpretation of what it means for a drug trial or a gene transfer trial to be responsive to the needs of a host community in which it's conducted.
I think an overriding question here is, why do you think researchers look to the developing world as a source of clinical trial participants?
In our article, we outline four main reasons. There's a fifth as well that we don't talk about that I'll mention really quickly. So the first reason is fortuity. There are some circumstances where a drug trial couldn't be pursued ethically in a high-income country because it would require depriving volunteers of standard of care, and it would expose them to undue amounts of risk. However, if you go into a low- and middle-income country where patients might not have access to a high-income standard of care, you can, in principle at least, pursue that study ethically, at least in terms of the risk-benefit part of the problem. So sometimes an individual's lack of access to standard of care creates a fortuitous research opportunity. The second reason is expedience. As we all know, sometimes it can be very challenging to recruit adequate numbers of volunteers to clinical trials, and this becomes a particular challenge when you're talking about genetic illnesses where you don't have a very high prevalence of the condition. And so to ease recruitment bottlenecks, sometimes researchers will try to expand the number of sites where they pursue studies. Obviously, there's a very large percentage of the world population is located in low- and middle-income countries, and so one way of accelerating the recruitment process is by expanding into low- and middle-income countries. The third reason is ultra-rarity, and this is one that is probably particular to interventions like gene transfer. There's some conditions that are just so profoundly rare and orphaned, that it would be virtually impossible to recruit adequate numbers of volunteers from a high-income country. And so, in the words of one researcher, they've had to, quote, scour the globe, unquote, for volunteers to participate in some of those types of studies. The other reason is kind of the reciprocal of the ultra-rarity, and that is there are some conditions that are highly prevalent in low- and middle-income countries for which it would be very difficult to recruit volunteers in high-income countries. A condition like malaria is very uncommon in high-income countries. Occasionally, tourists will get it when they travel to tropical regions. But if you want to do a malaria trial in terms of trying to find adequate numbers of patients to go into low- and middle-income countries. Now, the fifth rationale is one that we didn't talk about because in many ways I think it's not ethically as sort of difficult to sort out the various problems, and that's the issue of regulatory relief. For interventions like gene transfer, there is a fairly elaborate and, to some researchers and sponsors, difficult burden of regulations in high-income countries. So in the United States, you have to go through as many as four different committees to get a gene transfer trial approved. However, if you go to countries like China or Brazil, you may find a much more expedited regulatory process. And so that, I think, as well, is creating significant incentives to be pursuing these trials outside of the North American or European context.
Would you describe the key concerns you have about carrying out such early-stage trials, including those involving gene therapy, versus conducting phase two and phase three trials?
Phase three studies, as I indicated earlier, are run in part to determine efficacy. And so at a completion of a phase three study, you'll have evidence about whether or not the new intervention is better than the control intervention, whether that's placebo or standard of care. And so in that context, you have to think very seriously about whether or not that particular drug is going to be distributed to people who are on the study. You might also need to think about whether or not that particular drug is going to be distributed to people in the community. And that's a fairly, a fairly sort of concrete and tangible, ethical issue that you confront. in the context of phase one studies, where you're not gathering vindicating information about the efficacy of a drug, post-trial access or distribution of the drug itself to the communities doesn't really make a lot of sense. And this is one way in which, the ethics codes and policy has really sort of not developed an adequate response to, or way of addressing what it means to conduct a fair, ethically just phase one study. So in the context of a phase one study, what you need to think about is less the actual distribution of the particular drug and more the nature of the knowledge. Is the knowledge gathered? Does it have any relevance to the host communities? Is it likely that that knowledge, or is it a reasonable prospect that that knowledge will actually have some way of being integrated into healthcare interventions that these communities will ultimately benefit from? If the knowledge is entirely irrelevant, or if there's likely to be a very substantial delay between the collection of that knowledge and the development of an intervention that these host communities can use, then, in our opinion at least, the study fails the test of responsiveness. The knowledge lacks sort of a local relevance.
To address these concerns, what would your advice be to companies or scientists planning to carry out early stage trials in the developing world?
Unfortunately, because Lancet caps your word count at 2,000, we didn't really have adequate space to talk about solutions. And I'm always loath to write an article that, sort of describes what are sort of various ethical constraints without also trying to offer solutions or ways of addressing these issues. And I think there are a number of very promising avenues for drug companies as well as academic medical centers to fulfill these various conditions of responsiveness. And I just want to add something really quickly. I think that we tend to sort of think of stereotyped drug studies as being sponsored by pharmaceutical companies or, in the case of, gene transfer, biotech companies. But actually, a very large percentage of these studies are sponsored by foundations and academic medical centers as well. So this is something that is not strictly a private sector concern. It's as well a university concern. And again, I think there are a number of avenues that are open for sponsors, whether they be private or public, for-profit or nonprofit. One of them is that there are instances where biotech companies have set up fairly elaborate systems of what some people are calling pharmacophilanthropy. Genzyme is an example of this with their drug Cyrazyme, which is a drug for treating a lysosomal storage disease. They have set up a program that distributes that drug to persons in countries that won't be able to afford the exorbitant fee charged by Genzyme for access to that drug. And so I think that, if there seems to be a very good faith and tangible effort on the part of the sponsor to think forward about setting up these kinds of pharmacophilanthropy programs, I think that provides grounds to make a plausible claim, at least, that a drug study is potentially responsive. A second issue or second potential measure is a licensing policy on patents. So in many instances in these studies, intellectual property is being held by universities. And if universities sign licensing agreements that allow for production of generic products for import into low-income countries where those countries can't afford the fees that would normally be charged for high-income countries, again, that to me would indicate a good faith effort to try to make provisions to ensure that low and middle income countries are going to have access to the fruits of the knowledge collected in the study. A third sort of measure that could be considered is tiered pricing or discriminatory pricing regime, whereby there's a commitment in advance from the sponsor to charge a different fee for the drug in high-income countries than they'll charge in low- and middle-income countries. Last, I think it's very important for sponsors to provide careful documentation that the intervention they are testing addresses a health need, a priority health need, in that country, and that the intervention that they are testing is reasonably compatible with the various infrastructural, cultural, as well as economic constraints of the country. So in research ethics, when we review protocols, we don't just take researchers at their word on faith that risks and benefits are balanced appropriately or that informed consent is going to be obtained. We actually ask for evidence. We look at an informed consent document. That's evidence of how the consent process is going to proceed. We look at the investigator brochure, and that provides evidence, the preclinical evidence, et cetera, prior clinical evidence, provides evidence of that the risks and benefits are going to be appropriately balanced. It's the exact same thing for justice. I think what really matters here is that sponsors provide evidence that the knowledge collected in the study is going to have relevance to the host communities from which volunteers are being recruited.
My final question is, in the journal article, you and Dr. London wrote that you anticipated three major objections to your analysis. Which objections did you anticipate, and what are your responses?
One sort of obvious objection would be that our scheme is somehow denying people in low and middle-income countries access to potentially life-saving, cutting-edge interventions that are being tested in these studies. And I think a good example of this is the ADA SCID study that we talk about, as the first example of what we call a fortuitous phase one clinical trial opportunity. This is probably one of the most successful gene transfer trials that has ever been conducted in terms of clinical outcomes. In this instance, there were two children, one from Colombia, one from Palestine, who would almost certainly have died had they not had access to this study. And so by asking investigators to go, the extra mile in confirming the fairness of the study and the fulfillment of the justice requirements, some people might argue that we are essentially denying these people access to an intervention that could potentially save their life. I think there are a couple responses to this. I think this is a very serious criticism, and I don't in any way want to diminish what clinically was accomplished in those kinds of studies. And as an ethicist, I take very seriously the charge that in some way I'm interfering with another very favorable ethical outcome, which is saving individual lives. I think what's unfair here is not so much what we are arguing. I think what's unfair is that the only way for people in low and middle income countries to get access to an intervention is to offer themselves for trials of novel interventions where the risks are not really all that well understood and where the knowledge benefits, that is, are going to accrue almost entirely to people in high income countries. So I think that the charge really sort of misplaces, or that criticism at least misplaces where the ethical concerns are. So the second major criticism is sort of what we call the trickle-down theory. That is, when you pursue a trial and you gather knowledge, eventually that knowledge and eventually those interventions are going to trickle down to people in low and middle-income countries. And so, by definition, any clinical trial pursued in a low and middle-income setting is going to be responsive in some way. I think where this criticism fails is in two ways. Number one, if it were really true that any drug trial pursued in low to middle-income countries was ultimately going to be responsive because eventually interventions would trickle down to people in low and middle-income countries, then you'd sort of have to wonder, why is it that so many different ethics policies around the world, within nations as well as, international documents, articulate this requirement of responsiveness? What could they have had in mind by saying that drug studies have to fulfill responsiveness if every trial was always responsive? Clearly, they had more in mind than trickle-down. And I think the second rebuttal of this criticism is that I think the glacial pace at which healthcare interventions in high-income countries ultimately reach people in low- and middle-income countries is evidence that trickle-down is really not an adequate policy for addressing health needs in low- and middle-income countries. So the third criticism that individuals might make of our arguments, and this might be in reference to particular studies, is that in some instances, people will claim that the volunteers that were recruited to the studies that we describe actually had access to a very adequate standard of care in their low- or middle-income countries, that even poor countries have islands of prosperity. And if the study sponsors are recruiting from these islands of prosperity, these, you know, rich people living in very poor countries, then by definition, you know, there shouldn't really be any concerns about fairness for that study. And I think that that's basically true. I mean, I think that if, in fact, these studies are recruiting from affluent populations and low and middle-income countries, then one can make a claim that the knowledge they are generating is indeed responsive to the communities from which volunteers are being drawn. The problem is that if indeed you are recruiting from that affluent population, you kind of have to wonder why, in many cases, the sponsors are going to those low and middle-income countries at all. Why aren't they, you know, able to recruit adequate numbers in high-income countries? And our argument is that in many cases, perhaps not all cases, but at least in many cases, the reason for going to low and middle-income countries is mainly because volunteers might not have access to an adequate standard of care. And for them, the risk-benefit balance for a study, you know, for a phase one study is much more favorable than it would be for persons living in high-income countries that do have access to standard of care. And so we think it's going to actually be a small minority of studies where individuals from islands of prosperity within low and middle-income countries are being recruited into these studies.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.